funeral in Berlin. The interrogation lasted 3 days. Kafka didn't even bother to erase it from Pierce's timeline retroactively. Clearly, he was making a point about the unwisdom of crossing internal affairs. Afterward, Pierce left the hotel and wandered the streets of Berlin in a neurasthenic daze. Does Kafka trust me? Or not? On balance, probably not. The methodical, calm grilling he'd received, the interrogation about the precise meaning of Yarrow's love letters, faded memories from decades ago to Pierce's mind, had been humiliating, an emotional strip search. Knowing that Kafka understood his dalliance with Yarrow as a youthful indiscretion, knowing that Kafka clearly knew of and tolerated his increasingly desperate search for the point at which his history with Ziri had been overwritten, only made it worse. We can erase everything that gives meaning to your life if we feel like it. Feeling powerless was a new and shocking experience for Pierce, who had known the freedom of the ages. A return to his pre-stasis life, half-starved and skulking, frightened in the shadows of interesting times. And then there was the incipient paranoia that any encounter with internal affairs engendered. Am I being watched right now? He wondered as he walked. A ghost me surveillance officer working for internal affairs or something else? Kafka would be mad not to assign him a watcher, he decided. If Yarrow was under investigation, then he himself must be under suspicion. Guilt by association was the first rule of counter-espionage after all. A soul-blighting sense of depression settled into his bones. He'd had an inkling of it for months, ever since his increasingly frantic search in the library, but Kafka's quietly pedantic examination had somehow catalyzed a growing certainty that he would never see Ziri, or Magnus and Leanne, ever again. That if he could ever find them, shadows cast from his mind by the merciless inspection lamp glare of internal affairs would banish them farther into unhistory. Therefore, he wondered. Civilization lay like a heavy blanket upon the land, rucked up in grey-faced five-story apartment blocks and pompous stone-faced business establishments, their pillars and porticos and cornice work swollen with self-importance, like so many amorous street pigeons. The city sweated in the summer heat, the stench and flies of horse manure in the streets contributing a sour pungency to the sharp stink of stove smoke. Other people shared the Strasse with him. Here a peddler selling apples from a handcart. There a couple taking the air together. Pierce walked slowly along the sidewalk of a broad street, sweating in his suit and taking what shelter he could from the merciless summer sun beneath the awnings of shops, letting his phone's navigation aid guide his footsteps, even as he wondered despondently if he would ever find his way home. He could wander through the shadowy world of historicity forever, never finding his feet. For though the stasis and their carefully cultivated tools of ubiquitous monitoring had nailed down the sequence of events that comprised history, history was a tangled weave, many threads superimposed and re-dyed and snipped out of the final pattern. The scent was his first clue that he was not alone. Floral and sweet and tickling the edge of his nostrils with a half-remembered sense of illicit excitement that made his heart hammer. The shifting sands of memory gave way. I know that smell. His phone vibrated. Show no awareness, someone whispered inside his skull in Urim. They are watching you. The voice was his own. The strolling couple taking the air arm in arm were ahead of him. It was her scent, the familiar bouquet, but... Where are you? He sent. Show yourself. The phone buzzed again, like an angry wasp trapped inside his ribs. Not with watchers. Go to this location and wait, said the traitor voice, as a spatial tag nudged the corner of his mind. We'll pick you up. The rendezvous was a couple of kilometers away, in a public park notorious by night. A French letter drop for a dead letter drop. He tried not to stare. It might be her, he thought, trying to shake 30-year-old jigsaw memories into something that matched a glimpse of a receding back in late 19th-century dress and broad-brimmed hat. He turned a corner in his head, even as they turned aside into a residential street. Internal Affairs just interrogated me about Yarrow. You told us already. Go now. Leave the rest to us. Pierce's phone fell silent. He glanced sideways out of the corners of his eyes, but the strolling couple were no longer visible. He sniffed, flaring his nostrils in search of an echo of that familiar scent, but it too was gone. Doubtless they'd never been here at all. They were Stasis, after all. Weren't they? Guided by his phone's internal nudging, Pierce ambled slowly toward the park, shoulders relaxed and hands clasped behind his back as if enjoying a quiet afternoon stroll. But his heart was pounding, and there was an unquiet sensation in the pit of his stomach, as if he harbored a live grenade in his belly. You told us already. Go now. Leave the rest to us. His own traitor voice implying lethally spiraling cynicism. They are watching you. The words of a self-crowned pervert god, hubris trying to dam the flow of history. Or the mysterious opposition that Kafka had warned him of. It was imponderable, intolerable. I could be walking into a trap. Pierce considered the idea, and immediately began to activate a library of macros in his phone that he'd written for such eventualities. As Superintendent of Scholars Manson had ceaselessly reminded him, a healthy paranoia was key to avoiding further encounters with cardiac leeches and less pleasant medical interventions. Pierce crossed the street and walked beside a canal for a couple of blocks, then across a bridge and toward the tree-lined gates of a park. Possibilities hummed in the dappled shadows of the grass, like a myriad of butterfly wings broken underfoot, whispering on the edge of actuality like distant thunder. This part of history, a century and more before the emergence of the first Universal Surveillance Society, before the beginning of the history to which the Stasis laid claim, was mutable in small but significant ways. Nobody could say for sure who might pass down any given street in any specified minute and deem it disruptive. The lack of determinism lent a certain flexibility to his options. Triggering one of his macros as he stepped through the gates of the park, between one step and the next, Pierce walked through a storeroom in the basement of a Stasis station that had been dust and ruins a billion years before the ice sheets retreated from the North German plains. It had lain disused for a century or so when he entered it, and nobody else would use it for at least a decade thereafter. He'd set monitors, patient tripwires to secure his safe time. He tarried there for almost 3 hours, picking items from a well-stocked shelf and sending out messages to order them from a factory on a continent that didn't yet exist, eating a cold meal from a long-storage ration pack, and trying to regain his emotional balance in time for the meeting that lay ahead. An observer close on his tail would have seen a flicker. When he completed the stride, his suit was heavier, the fabric stiffer to the touch, and his shoulders slightly stooped beneath the weight concealed within. There were other changes, some of them internal. Perhaps the observers would see, but leave the rest to us. He slipped his hands into his pockets, blinked until the itching subsided, and the heads-up display settled into place across the landscape, scanning and amplifying. He had summoned watchers, circling over land, invisible and silent, nerves connected to his center. Fuck Kafka's little game, he thought furiously. Fuck them all. 3 hours in his unrecorded storeroom in the Cryptozoic had given him time for his depression to ferment into anger. I want answers. It was a hot day, and the park was far from empty. There were young women, governesses or maids, pushing the prams of their bourgeois employers, clerks or office workers skipping work, and some juvenile ne'er-do-wells playing truant from the gymnasium. Here a street sweeper, and there a dodgy character with a barrel organ, and behind him a couple of vagrants sharing a bottle of schnapps. At the centre of a well-manicured lawn, an ornate stone pedestal supported a clock with four brass faces. Pierce, letting his phone drive his feet, casually glanced around while his threat detector scanned through the chaff. Nobody. His phone buzzed again. What was the tavern where you fell for me called? An achingly familiar voice whispered in his ear. Something to do with wildfowl in Carnegra, the red goose or red duck or something like that. Hard contact in 3 seconds. His own voice interrupted from nowhere. Button up and hit the ground on my word. Now. Pierce dived toward the grassy strip beside the path as flaring crimson threat markers appeared all around him. As he fell, his suit bloated and darkened. Rubbery cones expanded like a frightened hedgehog's quills as his collar expanded and rotated, hooding him. In the space of a second, the park's population doubled, angular metallic figures flickering into being all around. Time flickered and strobed as time gates snapped open and shut, expelling sinister cargo. Pierce twitched ghost muscles convulsively, triggering camouflage routines as the incoming drones locked onto each other and spat missiles and laser fire. What's going on? Palimpsest ambush. Hard. The signal stuttered into silence, hammered flat by jammers and raw, random interference. Pierce began to roll, rising to sit as his suit's countermeasures flared. This is crazy, he thought, shocked by the violence of the attack. They can't hope to conceal. The sky turned violet white, the color of lightning. The grass around him began to smoke. The temperature rose rapidly. His suit was just beginning to char from the prompt radiation pulse as the ground opened under him, toppling him backward into darkness. Redux, Army of You. When you see the ground swallow Pierce, you will breathe a sigh of relief. You'll finally have the luxury of knowing that one of your iterations has made it out of Death Ground. But the situation will be too deadly to give you respite. If internal affairs are willing to start with combat drones and orbital X-ray lasers, then escalate from there, where will they stop? How badly do they want you? Very badly, it seems. There's going to be hell to pay when it's time for the cleanup. History doesn't have room for a nuclear blitzkrieg on the capital of the Second Reich. The calcinated, rapidly skeletonizing remains of the governesses and the organ grinders contort and burst in the searing wind from the Hiroshima miscarriage, and the four faces of the clock glow cherry red and slump to the ground as a dozen more of you flicker into view, anonymous in their heat-flashed silver battle armor. The echo armies of your combat drones fan out all around, furiously dumping heat through transient time gates into the cryogenic depths of the far future as they exchange fire with the enemy soldiers. Extraction complete. Prepare to move out, says your phone. The iteration tag of that version of you is astronomical, in the millions. This isn't just a palimpsest ambush. It's an entire Talmud of rewrites and commentaries and attempted paradoxes piled up in a threatening tsunami of unhistory and dumped on your heads. You'll grab your future self's metadata and jump toward a time gate to a dispersal zone drifting high in orbit above ruddy Jupiter's north pole, nearly a billion years in the future. The rocket motors at your suit's shoulders and ankles kick hard, and as you loft, you'll catch a flashing glimpse of the Mach wave from the first heat strike surging outward, lifting and crumpling schools and hospitals and churches and apartments and houses and shops in the iron name of internal affairs. They won't find this dispersal zone. They won't uncover the truth about control either, or about the opposition. You'll be sure of that for as long as you continue to live and breathe. You will look down between your feet at the swirling orange and cream chaos of Jupiter's upper atmosphere. Your armor will ping and tick quietly as it cools, and you will wait while the star trackers get a fix on your position, your mind empty of everything but a quiet satisfaction, the reward for a job well done. The extraction of your cardinal iterant from the grasp of internal affairs. Somewhere else in time, millions of years ago, the rewrite war is still going on. The virtual legions of you playing a desperate shell game with Kafka. But you've won. All that's left to do is to deftly insert the zombie ringer into history on his way into Kafka's court, primed to tell internal affairs exactly what you want them to know. Then to orchestrate a drawdown and withdrawal from the ruins of Berlin before Kafka overwrites the battle zone and restores the proper flow of history. Your suit will beep quietly for attention. Scan complete. it announces. Acceleration commencing. The thrusters will push briefly, reorienting you, sliding Jupiter out of sight behind your back. And then the rockets will kick in again, pushing you toward the yard and the fleet of 30-kilometer-long starships a-building, and Yarrow. He got your girl. I'm alive, thought Pierce, then did a double take. I'm alive? Everything was black, and he couldn't tell which way was up. There was a metallic taste in his mouth, and he ached everywhere. Where am I? He asked.
You'll have to wait while we cut you out of that,
said a stranger. Their voice sounded oddly muffled, and he realized with surprise that it wasn't coming from inside him.
You took an EMP that fried your suit. You only just made it out in time. You took several sieverts. We've got a bed waiting for you.
Something pushed at his side, and he felt a strange tipping motion. Am I in free fall? He asked.
Of course. Try not to move.
I'm not on Earth, he realized. It was strange. He'd effectively visited hundreds of planets with ever-shifting continents and biospheres, but he'd never been off Earth before. They were all aspects of Gaia, causally entangled slices through the set of all possible Earths that the Stasis called their own. Someone tugged on his left foot, and he felt a chill of cold air against his skin. His toes twitched.
That's very good. Keep doing that. Tell me if anything hurts.
The voice was still muffled by the remains of his hood, but he could place it now. Kari, a quiet woman, one of the trainees from the class above him. He tensed, panic rising in a choking wave.
Hey, Yarrow, he's stressing out.
Hold still, Pierce.
Yarrow's voice in his ears, also fuzzy.
Your phone's offline. It took a hit, too. Kari's with us. It's going to be all right.
You don't have any right to tell me that, he thought indignantly, but the sound of her voice had the desired effect. So Kari's one of them, too. Was there no end to the internal rot within the Stasis? In all honesty, considering his own concupiscence, possibly not. He tried to slow his breathing, but it was slowly getting stuffy and hot inside the wreckage of his survival suit. More parts detached themselves from his skin. He was beginning to itch furiously, and the lack of gravity seemed to be making him nauseous. Finally, the front of his hood cracked open and floated away. He blinked teary eyes against the glare, trying to make sense of what his eyes were telling him. Kari? The spherical drone floating before his face wore her face on its smart skin. A flock of gunmetal lampreys swam busily behind it, worrying at pieces of the dead and mildly radioactive suit. Some distance beyond, a wall of dull blue triangles curved around him, dish-like, holes piercing it in several places.
Try not to speak, said Kari's drone. You've taken a borderline fatal dose, and we're going to have to get you to a sick bay right away.
His throat ached.
Is Yarrow there?
Another spherical drone floated into view from somewhere behind him. It wore Ziri's face.
My love, I'll visit you as soon as you've cleared decontamination. The enemy are always trying to sneak bugs in. They wouldn't let me through to see you now. Be strong, my lord.
She smiled, but the worry wrinkles at the corners of her eyes betrayed her.
I'm very proud of you.
He tried to reply, but his stomach had other ideas and attempted to rebel.
Feel sick.
Someone kissed the back of his neck with lips of silver, and the world faded out. Pierce regained consciousness with an abrupt sense of rupture, as if no time at all had passed. Someone had switched his sense of awareness off and on again, just as his parents might once have power-cycled a bulky appliance.
Love? Pierce?
He opened his eyes and stared at her for a few seconds, then cleared his throat. It felt oddly normal. The aches had all evaporated.
We've got to stop meeting like this.
The bed began to rise behind his back.
Ziri?
Her clothing was outrageous to hegemonic forms, not to say anachronistic or unrevealing, but she was definitely his Ziri. As she leaned forward and hugged him fiercely, he felt something bend inside him, a dam of despair crumbling before a tidal wave of relief. "How did they find you?" he asked her shoulder, secure in her embrace. "Why did they reinstate—" "Hush, Pierce. He was so ill." He hugged her back. "I was? They kept me from you for half a moon, and the burns when they cut that suit away from you. What did you do?" Pierce pondered the question. "I changed my mind about something I'd agreed to do." They lay together on the bed until curiosity got the better of him. "Where are we? When are we? Where did you get that jumpsuit?" Ziri sighed, then snuggled closer to him.
"It's a long story," she said quietly. "I'm still not sure it's true."
"It must be, now," he pointed out reasonably. "But perhaps it wasn't for a while. But where are we?"
She eased back a little. "We're in orbit around Jupiter, but not for much longer."
"But I—" He stopped. "Really?"
"They disconnected your phone, or I could show you. The colony fleets, the shipyards."
He blinked at her, astonished.
"How?" "We all have phone implants here."
Her eyes sparkled with amusement.
"This isn't the stasis, you know."
"I'd guessed," he swallowed. "How long has it been for you?"
"Since—"
Her breath caught, a little ragged.
2 years. A little longer."
He gently trapped her right hand in his, ran his thumb across the smooth, plump skin on the back of her wrist. She let him.
"Almost the same."
He swallowed once more.
"I thought I'd never see you again. Anyone would think they'd planned this."
"Oh, but they did."
She gave a nervous little laugh.
"He said they didn't want us to desynchronize, get too far apart."
Her fingers closed around his thumb, constricting and warm.
"Who is he?"
asked Pierce, although he thought he knew.
"He used to be you, once. That's what he told me."
Her grip tightened suddenly.
"He's not you, love. It's not the same. At all."
"I must see him."
Pierce tried to sit up. Ziri clung to him, dragging him down.
"No, not yet," she hissed.
Pierce stopped struggling before he hurt her. His arms and his stomach muscles felt curiously strong, almost as if they'd never been damaged. "Why not?"
"Scholar Yarrow asked me to intercede. She said you'd want to confront him."
She tensed when she spoke Yarrow's name.
"She was right. About lots of things."
"What's her position here?"
"She's with him."
Ziri hesitated.
"It took much getting used to. I made a fool of myself once, early on."
He raised a hand to stroke her hair.
"I can understand that."
Pierce pondered his lack of reaction.
"It's been years since I knew her, you know. And if he's who, what, I think he is, he was never married to you, was he?"
"No."
She lay against him in silence for a while.
"What are you going to do?"
she asked in a small voice. Pierce smiled at the ceiling. It was low and bare of decoration, another sign, if he needed one, that he was not back in the hegemony. For the time being, the shock and joy of finding her again had left him giddy with relief. "Where are the children?" he asked, forcing himself. One last test.
"I left Leanne with a nurse. Magnus is away in the ship's Scholasticos."
Concern slowly percolated across her expression.
"They've grown a lot. Do you think—"
He breathed out slowly, relieved. "There will be time to get to know them again, yes." She reached over his chest and hugged him tight. He stroked her hair, content for the moment,
but sadly aware that everything was about to change. But tell me one thing. What is it that you're so desperate to keep from me?
Nation of Me. Good to see you, Pierce, said the man on the throne. He smiled pleasantly but distantly. I gather you've been keeping well. Pierce had already come to understand that the truly ancient were not like ordinary humans. Do you remember being me? He asked, staring. The man on the throne raised an eyebrow. Wouldn't you like to know? He gestured at the bridge connecting his command dais to the far side of the room. You may approach. Combat drones and uniformed retainers withdrew respectfully, giving Pierce a wide berth. He tried not to look down as he walked across the bridge, with only partial success. The storms of Jupiter swirled madly beneath his feet. It had made him nauseous the first time he'd seen them, through a dumb glass window aboard the low-G shuttle that had brought him hence. Evidently his captors wanted to leave him in no doubt that he was a long way from home. Occulting the view of the planet was the blue-tinged quicksilver disk of the largest time gate he'd ever seen, holding open in defiance of protocol with preposterous, scandalous persistence. Why am I here? Pierce demanded. A snort. Why do you think? You're me, Pierce shrugged. Me with a whole lot more experience and age and an attitude problem. They dressed him in the formal parade robes of a stasis agent, rather than the black jumpsuits that seemed to be de rigueur around this place. It was a petty move to enforce his alienation, and besides, it had no pockets. To fight back, he focused on the absurd. Black jumpsuits and shiny boots on a spaceship? Someone around here clearly harbored thespian fantasies. And now you've got me. His older self stiffened. We need to talk alone. His eyes scanned the throne room. You lot, dismissed. Pierce glanced round just in time to see the last of the human audience flicker into unhistory. He looked back toward the throne. I was hoping we could keep this civilized, he said mildly. You've got all the leverage you need. I'm in your power. There. It was out in the open. Not that there'd been any doubt about it, even from the beginning. This ruthless ancient, with his well-known mirror face and feigned bonhomie, had made Pierce's position crystal clear with his choice of greeters. All that was left was for Pierce to politely bare his throat and hope for a favorable outcome. I didn't rescue you from those scum in order to throw you away again. His older self seemed almost irritated. Though what you see in her... He shook his head. You're safe here. Pierce rolled his eyes. Oh, really? And I suppose if I decline to go along with whatever little proposition you're about to put to me, you'll just let me walk away? Is that it? Rather than, rewind the audience and try again with a clean sheet, me? He met the even gaze of the man in the throne and suddenly felt finger high. No, said the man on the throne after a momentary pause. That won't be necessary. I'm not going to ask you to do anything you wouldn't ask me to let you do. Oh, Pierce considered this for a moment. You're with the opposition, though, aren't you? And you know I'm not. Honesty made him add, yet. I told you he'd say that, said Yarrow behind him. Pierce's head whipped round. She nodded at him, but kept her smile for the man on the throne. He's young and naive. Go easy on him. The man on the throne nodded. He's not that naive, my lady. He frowned. Pierce, you slit the throat of your own double, separated from you by seconds. You joined the stasis after all. But do you really imagine it gets easier with age, when you've had time to meditate on what you've done? There's a reason why armies send the flower of their youth to do the killing and dying, not the aged and cynical. We have a name for those who find murder gets easier with experience. Monsters. He raised a hand.
Chairs all around.
A pair of seats appeared on the dais facing him, ghosts of carved diamond, fit for the lords of creation. I think you should be the one to tell him the news, he suggested to Yarrow. I'm not sure he'd believe me. He hasn't had time to recover from the trauma yet.
All right.
Yarrow slid gratefully into her own chair, then glanced at Pierce.
You'd better sit down.
Why? Pierce lowered himself into his seat expectantly.
Because.
She nodded at Pierce's elder self, who returned the nod with a dryly amused smile.
He's not just a member of the opposition. He's our leader. That's why internal affairs have been all over you like ants. And that's why we had to extract you and bring you here.
Rubbish! Pierce crossed his arms. That's not why you had to grab me. You've already got him. I assume I'm a palimpsest or leftover from an assassination attempt. So what do you want with me? In the here and now, I mean.
Yarrow looked flustered.
Pierce. His older self placed a restraining hand on her knee as he leaned forward.
Allow me?
He looked Pierce in the eyes.
The opposition is not, you probably already worked this out, external to the stasis. We come from within.
The stasis is broken, Pierce. It's drifting, rudderless, toward the end of time. We've got an alternative plan for survival. Internal affairs is tasked with maintaining internal standards. They're opposed to structural change at all costs. They overwrote your wife's epoch because they discovered possible evidence of our success.
The evidence of abandoned cities on an alien moon, the fleet of gigantic, slower-than-light colony starships. Was this all just internal politics within the stasis hierarchy?
Whatever would they want to do that for? He asked. They're not interested in deep space.
Except insofar as there were threats to the survival of humanity that had to be dealt with.
Yarrow shook her head. We disagree. They're very interested in deep space, specifically in keeping us out of it.
She inhaled deeply.
Did you notice, when you were consulting the library, any sign of histories that touched on extraterrestrial settlement? Even though we have re-terraformed the Earth thousands of times over, strip-mined the sun, rearranged gas giants, built black holes, and ripped an entire star system from its native galactic cluster?
Pierce shook his head, uncertain.
We've built and destroyed thousands of biospheres, sculpted continents, we outnumber the stars in the cosmos, but we've never spread to other solar systems. Doesn't that strike you as a little odd?
But we co-evolved with our planet. We're not adapted to life elsewhere.
Pierce stopped. We can do terraforming and time gates, he realized. Even if we can only have one wormhole end open at any given time. We rebuilt the sun. We've mapped every planet within 10 million light years.
Are we? He asked plaintively. There's a science empire running down on Earth right now, said the man on the throne. They've been studying that question for 12,000 years. We brought them the probe fleet reports. They say it can be done, and they've been building and launching a colony ship a year for the past 6 centuries. He frowned. We've had that big gate in place ever since the dawn of civilization, to block internal affairs from detecting and overriding our operation here. Officially, we're in the middle of a fallow epoch, and the system should be uninhabited and uninhabitable. We moved in ahead of the first scheduled reseeding. But they never give up. Sooner or later, they'll notice us and start looking for the other side of our barricade, the static drop we funneled you through.
What happens when they find it? Asked Pierce.
600 inhabited worlds die, and that's just for starters, Yarrow said quietly. Call it unhistory if you like euphemisms. But did your graduation kill feel unreal to you? Unlike your...
Her nose wrinkled in the ghost of a sniff.
Wife and children, the inhabitants of the colony worlds won't be retrievable through the library.
And those 600 planets are just the seed corn,
his older self chimed in. The start of something vast.
But why?
He asked. Why would they... He stopped.
The stasis isn't about historicity, said Yarrow. That might be the organization's raison d'etre, but the raw truth of the matter is that the stasis is about power. Like any organization, it lives and grows for itself, not for the task with which it is charged. The governing committee, it's very sad, but it's been like this as long as there's been a stasis.
We rescued you because we specifically want you, my first iteration, or as near to it as we've been able to get, give or take the assassination ambush in Carnegra, said the man on the throne. We need your help to cut us free from the dead hand of history.
But what?
Pierce lowered his hands to touch his belly.
My phone, he said slowly. It's damaged, but you could have repaired it. It's not there anymore, is it?
Yarrow nodded slowly.
Can you tell me why? She asked.
Reseeding. A Brief Alternate History of the Universe. Slide 1. Our Solar System Under the Stasis, First Epoch. Continents slide and drift, scurrying and scraping across the surface of the mantle. Lights flicker around the coastlines, strobing on and off in kilo-year cycles as civilizations rise and fall. In space, the swarm of orbital momentum transfer robots, built from the bones of Ceres, begin to cycle in and out, slowly pumping energy downwell to the Earth to drag it farther from the slowly brightening sun. Slide 2. Snapshot. Something unusual is happening. We zoom in on a 10,000-year slice, an eye-blink flicker of geological time. For millions of years beforehand, the Earth was quiet, its continents fallen dark in the wake of a huge burping hiccup of magma that flooded from the junction of the Cocos and Nazca continental plates. But now the lights are back, jewels sprinkled across the nighttime hemispheres of unfamiliar continents. Unusually, they aren't confined to the surface. Three diamond necklaces ring the planet in glory, girdling the equator in geosynchronous orbit. And floating beyond them, at the L1 Lagrange point betwixt Earth and Luna, sits the anomalous glowing maw of an unusually large time gate. The natives appear to be restless. Slide 3. A slow slide of viewpoint out to Jupiter orbit shows that the anomaly is spreading. Already some of the smaller Jovian moons are missing. Thebe and Amalthea have vanished, and something appears to be eating Himalaya. A metallic cloud of smaller objects swarms in orbit around Europa, pinpricks of light speckling their surface. Meanwhile, the shoals of momentum transfer bodies are thinning, their simple design replaced by numerous perversions of form and purpose. Still powered by light sails, the new vehicles carry exotic machines for harvesting energy from the solar wind and storing it as antimatter. Shuttles move among them like ants amidst an aphid farm, harvesting and storing their largesse as they swing out to Jupiter before dropping back in toward Mercury. Some of the hundreds of metal moons that orbit Europa are glowing at infrared wavelengths, their temperature suspiciously close to 300 degrees Kelvin. Against the planetary measure of the solar system, they are tiny, little bigger than the moons of Mars, but they're among the largest engineered structures ever built by the dreaming apes, vaster than cities and more massive than pyramids, and soon they will start to move. Slide 4. 3,000 years pass. Earth lies dark and unpopulated once more, for humanity, as always, has gone extinct. Of the great works in Jupiter orbit, few traces remain. The great ships have gone. The shipyards have long since been deorbited into the swirling chaos of the gas giant's atmosphere, and the malformed, warped transfer bodies have been cannibalized and restored to their original purpose. Five small moons have disappeared, and slowly healing gouges show the sites of huge mining works on Io and Europa. But by the time the stasis reseed Earth, 2/3 of a million years hence, even the slow resurfacing of Europa's icy core will have obscured the signs of industry. It may be thousands of years after that before anybody notices. Slide 5. 20 million years pass, and the galaxy slowly lights up with a glare of coherent light, waste energy from the communications traffic between the inhabited worlds. The first generation colonies have long since guttered into senescence and extinction. So have the third and fourth generations. Of the first generation, barely 1 in 5 prospered. But that was sufficient. Those that live spawn prolifically. Planets are common, rocky terrestrial bodies far from rare, and even some of the more exotic types, water giants, tide-locked rocky giants in orbit around red dwarfs and others, are amenable to human purpose. Where no planets are available, life is harder, prone to sudden extinction events. Nobody survives the collapse of civilization aboard a space colony. But the tools and technologies of terraforming are well known, and best practice of a kind develops. Many of the dwellers have adapted to their new habitat so well that they're barely recognizable as primates anymore, or even mammals. Slide 6. 3 billion years pass. 2 huge glittering clouds of sentience fall through each other, a magnificently coordinated flypast of fleets of worlds meshing across the endless void. Shockwaves thunder through the gas clouds, and millions of massive, short-lived new stars ignite and detonate like firecrackers. The starburst is indeed enormous. But for the most part, the inhabited worlds are safe. Swarms of momentum transfer robots, their numbers uncountable, work for millions of years ahead of and behind the event to direct the closest encounters. Emergent flocking rules and careful plans laid far in advance have steered colonies clear of the high-risk territories, marshalling brown dwarfs as dampers and buffers to redirect the tearaway suns, and both galaxies are talking to each other, for the expanding sphere of sentience now encompasses the entire local group. Earth is no longer inhabited in this epoch, but the precious time gate remains, an oracular hub embedded in a cluster of exotic artificial worlds, conducting and orchestrating the dance of worlds. There are now 100 million civilizations within the expanding bubble of intelligence, each with an average population of billions. They are already within an order of magnitude of the stasis's ultimate population, and they are barely 1/1000th of its age. The universe, it appears, has started to wake up. Slide 7. The crystal ball is clouded. The kindest lies. They walked along a twisting path between walls of shrubs and creepers and a few short trees growing from mounds of damp-smelling soil. The path appeared to be of old sandstone, shot through with seams of a milky rock-like calcite. Appearances were deceptive. "You played me like a flute," said Pierce. He held his hands behind his back, as was his wont, keeping an arm's reach aside from her.
"I did not."
Her denial was more in hurt than in anger.
"I didn't know about this until you recruited me."
Her boot scuffed a rock, leaning like a rotten tooth from the side of a herbaceous border. Tiny insects scuttled from her toes unnoticed.
"I was still in training, like you when you were tapped for other things."
They walked in silence for a minute, uphill and around a winding corner, then down a flight of steps cut into the side of a low hill.
"If this is all simply an internal adjustment, why doesn't Internal Affairs shut everything down?" he asked. "They must know who is involved."
"They don't," she shook her head.
"When you call in a request for a time gate, your phone doesn't say, 'By the way, this iteration of Pierce is a member of the opposition.' All of us were compliant once. If they catch us, they can backtrack along our history and undo the circumstances that led to our descent into dissidence. And sometimes we can catch and isolate them, put them in an environment where doubt flourishes. If they started unmaking every agent suspected of harboring disloyal thoughts, it would trigger a witch hunt that would tear stasis apart. We're not the kind who'd go quietly.
Hence their insistence on control, alienation from family and other fixed reference points, complicity in shared atrocity. They aim to stifle disloyal thoughts before the first germination. Huh. They came to a fork in the path. A stone bench, stained gray and gently eroded by lichen, sat to one side. Were you behind the assassination attempt then? No. She perched tentatively at one side of the bench. That was definitely internal affairs. They were after him, not you. Him? The iteration of you that never stayed in the hegemony. Never met Ziri, eventually drifted into different thoughts and met Yarrow again under favorable circumstances. Pierce slowly turned around as she was speaking, but in every direction he looked there was no horizon, just a neatly landscaped wall of mazes curving gently toward the zenith. It seems to me that they're out of control. Yes. She became intent, focused, showing him her lecturer's face. All organizations that are founded for a purpose rapidly fill with people who see their role as an end in itself. Internal affairs are a secondary growth. If they ever succeed, there won't be anything left of the stasis but internal affairs. Everyone spying on themselves for eternity and a day, trying to preserve a single outcome without allowing anyone to ask why. Not everything added up. Still thinking, Pierce sat down gingerly at the other side of the bench. Not looking at her, he said, I met Imad and Layla, Ziri's parents. How could they have survived? Everyone kills their own grandparents. It's the only way to get into the stasis. How did you survive your graduation? She turned and looked at him, her eyes glistening with unshed tears. You can be very slow at times, Pierce. What? You don't have to abide by what they made you do, my love. Corrupt practices, the use of complicity in shared atrocities to bind new recruits to a cause, it was a late addition to the training protocol, added at the request of internal affairs. It may even be what sparked the first muttering of opposition. We've got the luxury of unmaking our mistakes, even to go back, unmake the mistake, and not enter the stasis, despite having graduated. Agents do that sometimes when they're too profoundly burned out to continue. They go underground. They run and cut themselves off. That's why there was no agent covering the hegemony period you landed in. They'd erased their history with the stasis, going into deep cover. You say they. Are you by any chance trying to disown their action? He asked gently. No. Now she sounded irritated. I regret nothing. She regrets nothing. Withholding the truth from you from all those years? Well, what would you have done if you'd known that your adoring Ziri, the mother of your children, was a deep cover agent of the opposition? What would you have done? She reached across and seized his elbow, staring at him, searching for some truth he couldn't articulate. I don't know. His shoulders slumped. All those years, you were under observation by other instances of yourself, sworn in service to internal affairs, reporting to Kafka, she pointed out. Honesty wasn't an option. Not unless you can guarantee that all of those ghost instances would be complicit in keeping the secret from the moment you were recruited by the stasis. That's why, back in college... The moment of enlightenment was shocking. Yarrow's mouth, seen for the first time, wide and sensual, the pale lips, his reaction. He looked across the bench, saw the brightness in her eyes as she nodded. I'd never betray her. It happened more than once, according to the final library. They can make you betray anyone if they get their claws into you early enough. The only way to prevent it is to make a palimpsest of your whole recruitment into the stasis, to replace your conscript youth with a disloyal imposter from the outset, or to decline the invitation altogether and go underground. But I'm not him, exactly. She let go of his elbow. Not unless you want to be, my love. Am I your love? Or is he? That depends which version of you you want to be. You're telling me that essentially I can only be free of internal affairs if I undo what they made me do. There's a protocol, she said, looking away. We can reactivate your phone. You don't have to re-enlist in the stasis if you don't want to. There are berths waiting for all of us on the colony ships. But that's just exchanging one sort of reified destiny for another, isn't it? Expansion in space instead of time. Why is that any better than, say, freeing the machines, turning over all the available temporal bandwidth to time-like computing to see if the wild-eyed prophets of artificial intelligence and ghosts uploaded in the machines were onto something after all? She looked at him oddly. Do you have any idea how weird you can be at times? He snorted. Don't worry, I'm not serious about that. I know my limits. If I don't do this thing we're discussing, him upstairs will be annoyed. Because Kafka will have all those naively loyal young potential me's to send on spy missions, won't he? Piers took a deep breath. I don't see that there's any alternative, really. And that's what rankles. I had hoped that the opposition would be willing to give me a little more freedom of action than Kafka, that's all. He felt the ghostly touch of a bunch of raisin-wrinkled grape joints holding his preteen wrists, showing him how to cast a line. He owed it to Grandpa, he felt, to leave his own children a universe with elbow room, unconstrained by the thumb cuffs of absolute history. Will you still be here when I get back? She regarded him gravely. Will you still want to see me afterward? Of course. See you later, then. She smiled as she stood up, then departed. He stared at the spot where she'd been sitting for what seemed like a long, long time. But when he tried to remember her face, all he could see was the two of them, Ziri and Yarrow, superimposed. Saying goodbye to now. 20 years in stasis. Numerous deaths, many of them self-inflicted, ordered with a callous detachment of self-appointed gods. They feed into the unquiet conscience of a man who knows he could have been better, can still be better, if only he can untangle the Gordian knot of his destiny after it's been tied up and handed to him by people he's coming to despise. That's you in a nutshell, Pierce. You're at a bleak crossroads, surrounded by lovers and allies, and oh, so isolated in your moment of destiny. Who are you going to be, really? Who do you want to be? All the myriad ways will lie before you, all the roads not taken at your back. Who do you want to be? You have met your elder self, the man-machine at the center of an intrigue that might never exist if Kafka gets his way. And you'll have mapped out the scope of the rift with Ziri, itself rooted in her despair at stasis. You can examine your life with merciless, refreshing clarity, and find it wanting if you wish. You can even unmake your mistakes. Let Grandpa flower, prune back your frightened teenage nightmare of murder. You can step off the murderous infinite roundabout whenever you please, resign the game, or rejoin and play to win. But the question you've only recently begun to ask is, who writes the rules? Who do you want to be? The snow falls silently around you as you stand in darkness, knee-deep in the frosted weeds lining the ditch by the railroad tracks. Alone in the night, a young man walks between islands of light. A headhunter stalks him unseen. Another young man with a heart full of fears and ears stuffed with lies. There's a knife in his sleeve and a pebble-sized machine in his pocket. And you know what he means to do and what will come of it. And you know what you need to do. And now it's your turn to start making history.
The end. You've been listening to Palimpsest, the final story in this collection, narrated by Gideon Emery. Palimpsest wanted to be a novel. It really, really wanted to be a novel. Maybe it will be, someday. And maybe I could have gotten away with making it a short novel, just to round out this collection with an example of every format of fiction, if it wasn't for the imaginary voice of my editor nagging at the back of my head. Do you know how much it costs to print a hardcover once it goes over 500 pages? Part of the reason novels are the length they are is the cost of printing and binding. Binding a fat book is disproportionately more expensive than binding two thinner ones, and there is a downward pressure on the price of hardbacks, which makes it difficult for publishers to show a profit on a fat volume. No surprise, then, that many recent big fat fantasy novels have shown up split into two or more thinner volumes. Perhaps once publishing moves wholesale onto the internet, fashions in fiction length and the disappearance of printing and binding costs will lead to more and longer novels. But in the here and now, this short story collection is pushing the limits of what I can get away with, without any need to add another 100,000 words. This ends Wireless, stories by Charles Stross, narrated in order by Tim Gerard Reynolds, Gideon Emery, Paul Hecht, and Robert Ian McKenzie, with an introduction and afterwards narrated by me, your host, John Curlis. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Wall of the Sky, The Wall of the Eye. Stories by Jonathan Lethem, narrated by Graham Winton and Kevin R. Free. A dead man is brought back to life so he can support his family in The Happy Man. Occasionally, he slips into a zombie-like state while his soul is tortured in hell. In Vanilla Dunk, future basketball players are given the skills of old-time stars like Michael Jordan and Wilt Chamberlain. And in Forever, Said the Duck, stored computer personalities scheme to break free of their owners. In these and other stories in this striking collection, Jonathan Lethem draws the reader into his strange, unforgettable world, a trip from which there may be no easy return. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.